You are listening to Essence, a podcast about story, journey, and self. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Essence Podcast Into the Woods, where I go and venture into the woods to find traditional and folkloric witchcraft and practitioners. And today I have a really special guest. I have Kobe Michael on. Hello, Kobe.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for accepting and thank you for joining me. So for those of you who don't know Kobe, and I think actually most of the people who are listening to this have most heard of you through your book, The Poison Path Herbal, or through all of your various other activities. And if you don't know who Kobe is, if you're kind of new to this world or this niche part of the world, we have a small bio. So Kobe Michael is a practitioner of the poison path, of occult herbalism, and a cultivator of entheogenic herbs. He contributes to the pagan archives at Valdosta University, writes regularly for the House of Twigs, and maintains a blog, Poisoner's Apothecary, on Paphios Pagan. He is the host of the Botanica Obscura conference. He teaches classes and online workshops on plant magic, baneful herbs, and traditional witchcraft, and he lives in Florida. To find out more, go to the poisonersapothecary.com. So welcome again, Kobe.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So to start off, most people, I think, if they haven't attended any of the conferences you put together or any of the speaking events you've been part of, they probably know you through this book. So I want to know a little bit about kind of the what brought you to writing this book. I know you started originally putting it together in 2017, and it evolved through many different processes. Tell us a little bit about that journey.
Well, I had just left Florida and moved back up north the first time when I started putting the booklets together. And it was the winter after I had my first sort of deadly nightshade experience. That kind of really solidified and kick-started the desire to really work with these plants more deeply. So it was just through, you know, the previous 5-6 years of research and note-taking and just kind of compiling all of this stuff from all sorts of different places that I started putting it together. And I started to notice some patterns and some connections that I thought were, really important when it comes to what we would call traditional witchcraft. So for me, it was kind of a crystallization of all of these different elements that I found sort of wrapped up within the mythology and folklore associated with poisonous plants, specifically the nightshade family. We can also add things like wolfsbane, hellebore, poison hemlock, and that.
Makes sense. That makes sense. I know in another interview you'd made the comment that so many of the kind of the material that was out there or was available was really focused on European and Middle Eastern plants. But growing up in the South, growing up in Florida and a little bit north from there, what was it like for you, and how did you connect with the plants that were in North America? What was your process with them?
So, I grew up in Indiana, which, you know, similar climate, I guess, to like Northwestern Europe. I mean, we have all four seasons and it's gray and rainy and snows sometimes, but we didn't have anything like deadly nightshade or henbane or mandrake or any of the big sort of witching herbs. I connected through plants just via gardening, and that's kind of my gateway drug into magical practice in general. Just that initial sort of connection to nature, working in the garden with my grandfather. And then I spent a lot of time just out in the woods behind my house, by myself, or maybe like with my sisters or a friend or two. But a lot of my childhood was spent in the woods, and just feeling like all of those trees around you can't see any of the houses, like you're safe, you're protected. And I just really resonated and connected with that. And I've always had a thing for grabbing like random twigs and leaves and berries and sort of mixing them together and creating like these brews and concoctions. And even though I really didn't know what I was doing at the time or have any kind of specific intention, just that act of like going out and bringing together these different components and creating something just felt really powerful to me.
I feel the same way. Some of the things I used to do as a kid, that empowerment piece in other ways, right? Yeah. Yeah. What was the turning point for you? When did you start to kind of put two and two together and see, okay, there's more than just kind of playing with this. There's more than just that childhood experience. There's power, there's a magic, there's a witchcraft in this. What was that? What was the turning point?
Well, I think I was always seeking it on some level. And I think in a lot of ways, it was inevitably going to find me, or I was going to find it one way or another. You know, it was right around the time that AOL Instant Messenger and GeoCities and Angel Fire websites were becoming popular. And you had these really cool, like, elaborately graphic designed web pages with like a little floating magic wand for a cursor, and they were all very much like Wiccan oriented, which is cool. But that was kind of my first discovery that, you know, people outside of Hollywood and Disney movies and fairy tales and books were actually seriously like, you know, putting some effort into putting this information out there. And, you know, it's just a more like real context, I guess. So it was something that I've just always had a fascination with. For whatever reason, I've always been attracted to witches, whether it was the Wicked Witch of the West that I dressed up for more than one Halloween, you know, Hocus Pocus, Practical Magic, even like some of my earliest childhood books were about witches. You know, I would carry around a plastic cauldron pretty much all year round. It was just something that I was fascinated with and infatuated by. And the craft came out in the mid 90s. And I think, you know, looking back on that now, also with the satanic panic happening, and then being in a Christian household, there was a little bit of backlash that came with like this persistent interest that I had in spirits and magic and witches and spooky things. And I think in a lot of ways that sort of vehement reaction that family members would have almost kind of fueled me in that direction even more, because I knew like deep down inside that this was not a bad thing, that this thing that had been with me, you know, throughout the entirety of my life since I could remember was not something like harmful or destructive or malicious, and almost felt like protective of it, because in a lot of ways that's sort of how, you know, it made me feel like as a person then, that I was like somehow tainted and evil and sinful and all of those things.
Absolutely. I would not be surprised if most listeners listening to this really resonates with that. I know I do. The idea of like finding safe harbor in this and feeling empowerment in this and really identifying. I know for me, like, I think we're of a similar age. I just turned 37. And I remember being on, you know, GeoCities and Angel Fire websites and WitchFox and all of these, right? And really finding connection with otherness there. And I'm curious for you, what aspects of your life, like what aspects of your identity really found gravitas in this witchcraft for you?
So much of it, I think, has been wrapped up in my sexuality and my identity and that ability to glamour and attract and draw in and to influence, you know, that being very much like a just sort of a natural personal ability, I guess, that I really resonated with. For me, I don't know. I think there were just so many instances, like in my childhood and in my early life, where I felt really, really powerless. And a lot of that came from a masculine source, one way or another. And so this was a way for me to really just tear that apart and take control of it and make it mine. And very much like a seductive and drawing in element, but then also like, with the knife behind your back, just waiting to like pounce at any moment. So very like dualistic kind of a vibe there, if that even makes sense. But I think for a lot
that
of
totally
queer
makes
people,
sense.
Witchcraft and sexuality are very much intertwined.
I totally agree. I totally agree. In my summer series, I didn't really heavily promote it in this way, just to gain listeners. But the vast majority of all the people in my summer series were queer. And a lot of the people who are on this season are all queer. And they came to that sense of other, that finding empowerment in other, right? I'm curious then for you, you went all over the place kind of in seeking, and you came across hoodoo and you started to investigate hoodoo. Can you talk a little bit about that? What was that like for you to connect as somebody from Indiana, first of all, to connect in with kind of Southern hoodoo and that? What was that like for you?
It was a very, romantic journey. I always kind of romanticized New Orleans, and we could probably credit a lot of that to Anne Rice, and then learning, about New Orleans voodoo and different folk practices in the area. I think too, it was just a matter of like what was popular and ubiquitous at the time. And it was like right around the time when like the traditional witchcraft publishers were like maybe just kind of barely starting, but still very obscure. And then we have like all of this information online. Various different websites with all of these hoodoo correspondences. And for me, it just seemed like hoodoo offered something that was more practical, something that could actually help people get what they wanted, whether, there was any kind of like moral judgment on what that was or not, didn't really matter. They weren't afraid to talk about hexing, cursing, the darker side of it, working with plants that are poisonous, or plants from the graveyard, or even some, recipes using poisonous insects and lizards and things like that. So it was like this whole other world of magical practice that nobody, like up until that point in my sphere of awareness, was really talking about. It was all very much like, oh, well, chamomile for joy and lavender for relaxation and lemon balm. There's, they're great, but there's really only so many things that you can do with lavender and lemon balm and bay leaves and chamomile. And I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's true. Yeah.
Just like the giving that permission, that this was even something like worth looking into, that it wasn't just, oh, well, all of the bad, spooky, scary stuff was just mythology and it was just made up. And we've really just been, healers and herbalists and things like that throughout the centuries. And that's, I just don't believe that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that showing of that discomfort while in the discourse, right? It's like, well, the witch has always been the spooky, the scary, the dark, the other, right? And so stripping the other away from these traditions, I feel you on that one. I really do. I do. So tell me about traditional witchcraft then. What was that turnover for you? What was that changeover for you?
It was really through my study and practice of hoodoo and other, loosely related folk practices that I found really the grimoire tradition, and kind of branched out and came back around full circle into the traditional witchcraft or European witchcraft, medieval witchcraft, whatever we want to call it, which has kind of become like a loaded term in and of itself. You know, is it capital T traditional, lowercase traditional? Is it traditional British witchcraft? Or, you know, are we talking about like European folkloric witchcraft? And there's all of these different like qualifiers, which are important, but then they also kind of like discount all of these other witchcraft related folkloric traditions that don't necessarily like fit into those boxes either. So it can be kind of weird, like navigating, communicating about these things when you're trying to, you know, define something very specific to you, but then also not, you know, decategorize or, you know, try and make separate like all of these other things, because the witch, you know, as we know, it's a worldwide archetype, it's a worldwide spirit. You know, there's all sorts of ways that witchcraft has been interpreted and perceived, and we do have this idea in, you know, not only like European or English speaking places, but in other parts of the world too, that are using a completely different language. You know, there are magical practitioners and there are witches, and there's always a distinction. And I feel like, oh, we're kind of like getting to this point where we're trying to make it so accessible for everyone that we've really torn away a lot of the core things that are that idea of the witch, and kind of bringing it into like the modern usage. You know, yes, healing, yes, you know, ancestral work, and you know, spells for prosperity and abundance and attracting all of these great things and protecting your loved ones. But there's also like this element of taboo and transgression and just real, you know, primal power that feels dark and feels scary and will always be that way, because that's in and of its very nature. That's what we're digging for, I think.
Well, this I think this is a good point. This is something I was curious to ask you anyways, but I think this is a good segue to it. My perception, having done a lot of these interviews now with fellow or colleagues of ours, and also now kind of really noticing the way that these discourses are happening in the community, I've noticed that there can tend to be, especially with the poison path, this romanticization, this idea of the, you know, the Victorian apothecary, and it becomes a very, on some levels, not everybody, on some levels, kind of like a live action role play of this figure in the community, right? And I think that, I mean, certainly I have ideas around that, but I feel like that can often bring people to this type of work who aren't necessarily either ready for it or who don't really understand what it's about. What do you think the draw is for people to the poison path that you've noticed? What is the draw, do you think?
Kind of leaving the topic of just like the psychedelic renaissance and altered states of consciousness on the side for right now. I think that people are instinctually just attracted to the word poison. You know, it's on a warning signs for a reason. It's just part of like our archetypal consciousness, or just the basic things that we are hardwired to know and understand. And poison is one of those. And that goes back to very, very early just kind of survival mechanisms. And so I think people are always ultimately going to be attracted to things that can potentially harm them or have like this sinister air around them. And it's no different than someone that likes to have like a pet tarantula or a pet snake. You know, it's kind of part of that aesthetic. But deeper than that, you know, those people, myself included, you know, they're connecting to those on a deeper level and resonating with those things for a specific reason, versus, you know, wanting to work with a rabbit spirit or, you know, like the spirit of Rose. You know, there's a reason that we're attracted to specific things, and it's sort of an alignment of the energies that are within us and also present in those things that kind of bring us together. But, you know, poison and apothecaries and underground witchcraft has always kind of been a thing, and it's always had charlatans. It's always had people that abuse the power that comes with that. And especially when you get into psychoactive plant material and hypnotics and things where like you literally like drug people, and has been done, you know, in ancient Greece and India, various different places throughout history. There's also, you know, the potential for like cults of personality to sort of pop up. And now you're dispensing all of this psychedelic pharmaca to the world, and you've got the keys to heaven, just like the priests do.
Yeah.
Slippery slope.
It is a slippery slope. Yeah. I'm curious with that then. I know you, the way you wrote this and the way you present this body of information, you are very, very, very careful, obviously, for very good reasons. But I feel like you're also a very practical, empowering person. When you're working with students, when you're working or talking to your audience through your books, through your content, what is it that you're hoping to empower? Because there feels like an empowerment piece in the way you present and the way you speak and the way you put this out there. What is it that, what's the intended thing to empower, do you think?
The biggest thing is to take away the fear, you know, to show historical precedent, whether it's 19th century pharmaceutical preparations, or, you know, what we may have, you know, from 15th century, like flying ointment recipes, you know, show that people were actually using these, they were being used medicinally. They did have the potential for poisoning, which doesn't always mean death. They did have the potential to alter consciousness, but they're very much like medicinal preparations. And, you know, the first most common thing that people ask me is like, oh, well, how do I use this? What do I do with it? I'm like, well, they're really no different than how you work with like any other plant, ritual formula, spirit ally, deity. They're really not. And there's just this big body of fear, maybe not even fear, but disempowerment, in the sense that you've got to be, you know, super knowledgeable about botany and phytochemistry and doing these alchemical extractions. And it just kind of sets it up as like this inaccessible thing in a way. And I think that certain people have kind of benefited from that. And, you know, with what I try and do in my writing and my work is, you know, empower people to be able to do it themselves, because that's as, you know, as big a part of the journey as any of it, you know, starting down here and just working your way up slowly is a very Saturnian and slow approach. You know, if you just walk outside and find a Datura plant and decide that you want to work with the Datura spirit, and you grab a few leaves and make a tea and drink it, and, you know, you're going to be in really terrifying, excruciating scenario for probably the next 72 hours and should probably get to the hospital. But there's all of these different rungs, you know, on the ladder of consciousness to connect with these spirits that don't involve that very dramatic and dangerous side of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That comes through a lot in how in the material that you've put out, is that idea of that relationship piece, that building that relationship piece. And I know you've spoken about this in other contexts, but the relationship in just watching a plant grow, being part of that whole process from start to finish. I'm kind of curious, can you tell us what it was like for you to grow your first kind of entheogenic plant, or within legal limits, of course? What was it like for you to grow and work with that little thing?
Yeah, I was going to say my first was a cannabis plant in my closet, and I was like 19, but that didn't amount to anything. First kind of baneful herb was deadly nightshade, Tropa belladonna, and Gosh, I don't even know how to explain that, but just to have in your presence and in your physical vicinity and be caring for this plant that just has like so much associated like history and folklore and just it they're just like emissaries of these witchcraft spirits or mighty dead or ancestors of tradition or whatever you want to call it. I really think that the poisonous plants really embody that and they act as emissaries for these spirits. So having the physical plant they're growing is great and awesome and a lot gets transmitted through that, but it's no different than wanting to connect to the goddess Hecate. And so you start reading about Hecate's mythology and traditions and how people have worshipped and honored her in the past and all of these different things. That's she didn't do that. People did that, but it's part of her story. And when we read that, we really tap into it. And that's I feel like the same thing with these plants. They're not all going to grow everywhere. They're not all easy to grow, especially from seed. I know they're becoming more available. And like, yes, there are poisonous plants available everywhere. But it's really like these few core ones that really, for me, represent these sort of archetypal spirits of witchcraft. The witch father, the mercurial god, the dark and light aspects of Venus, and just all of these things that we talk about, we can find like a poison plant corollary.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And those niches show up regardless of what landscape we're talking about. I was chatting to Albert Bjorn Scheel, who writes for Crosscrow Books, and he came out with the Icelandic plant herbal, and he was talking about, especially from somebody who was from England originally, what it was like to connect with the flora of Iceland and get to know those plants, even if he knew them from before, or knew the regional variation in England. But the how the niches show up again and again and again, right?
Yeah, totally.
So this kind of brings me to kind of a side conversation, but something that I always find interesting is how, and you pointed towards that, the idea that, humans are telling these stories, humans are developing these relationships, and about these plans, and how much of the folklore tends to be very anthropocentric, it tends to be very human centric. I'm wondering, through your work and kind of your development with your relationships with these plants, what have you noticed about the relationships between the plant spirits themselves? Have you had much of an insight? Have they allowed you to have much of an insight into their relationships with each other?
In my mind, they seem to exist pretty separately. They are Saturnian herbs. They're all about boundaries and constraint and containment. So there is overlap. I think in general, poisonous plants can be used for some specific purposes, but then they also have like their own very unique kind of niche areas that they specialize in. Bringing together other herbal allies too, we can tap into and sort of draw out more specific qualities or virtues. It doesn't always have to be about like the dark aspect of it. There are a lot of like positive or light aspects too, however we want to categorize that, that can be brought out through the incorporation of other plant allies. I find that they have a lot of an affinity to mushroom spirits. So not so much like talking between poisonous plants or Datura and deadly nightshade or whatever, but working with the mushrooms as intermediary allies to connect with the spirits of poisonous plants or baneful herbs in a way that we're able to get that transmission without having to actually ingest that specific plant. So the mushrooms are super duper helpful at kind of transmitting that. They're almost like a filter, or can shape into the form of that belladonna spirit without you actually literally having to invite that spirit of death into your body.
Right. Right. That makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. Mushrooms are, I mean, apart from the psychedelic aspects, which I love, 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 love. But I feel like they're very underserved when it comes to witchcraft. We don't tend to, at least some of the 101 kind of books that would say go and work with this rabbit spirit, right? They don't tend to talk about mushrooms much. Why do you think that is? Why do you think mushrooms don't tend to get talked about much?
I think part of it is just a product of like Western society, or you know, there's a lot of mycophobia or mushroom fear, I feel like, in Great Britain. And I think that that kind of bled over to North America, where in places like Scandinavia, you know, people are eating Amanita as like dinner, cooking it and preparing it in different ways. And of course, like Asia, we see a lot of medicinal mushrooms and just mushrooms being used culinary in general. But it just seems like there's this fear that has trickled over in regards to that. And I think it's starting to kind of go away. I know Nathan Hall writes about mushroom magic and connecting to mushroom allies in his book. I think off the top of my head, anybody else? Of course, you know, Tom Hatzis loves mushrooms and writes about them extensively, microdosing and things like that. But even with adaptogenic mushrooms like lion's mane, you know, we think about like honing our psychic skills and our ability to concentrate and raise and direct energy. That's literally a lot of what adaptogens do and help us do, and they just sort of fine-tune our nervous system and these energetic pathways. So, you know, course they're going to be supportive for witchcraft, spiritual practice. So I think we're just finally starting to remember and realize the importance of fungi.
I'm going to speak as a therapist here, because in therapy in North America, particularly with psychedelics, there's a big interest, and the pharmaceutical companies are starting to kind of really glean onto that. And so my concern is, well, speaking as a therapist here, my concern is that pharmaceuticals are going to try and take over that and suddenly
they will
commodify it. And I know, I really don't want it to, but I know it will. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking it's inevitable.
That's the trouble, though. It is inevitable, isn't it? And even within the natural health industry, right, taking up the herbal remedies, it became way too much. I have a lot of criticism of that, but that's outside the context of this conversation. But let's talk about the healing process then, because I know for my own, and I've been candid about that in other interviews, part of my own real work involved plant allies and mushroom allies in healing. Healing through your relationships with poison path and poisonous materia has been a big part of your own journey, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it really has.
Yeah.
It's been a long journey. Very Saturnian. Sort of.
I know you've talked a lot about it, and I'm curious. I'm curious now, kind of a few years out of that for yourself, and still in, not still in that recovery mode, but on that path of recovery, what is it like for you to talk about that relationship in as part of your healing journey with that now, like in contemporary, you know, 2023?
It wasn't something that I really felt was going to be part of, you know, what I was doing as like a witchy author or witchy person. It was always just sort of like my own personal issue that I needed to deal with, that, you know, I kept putting over there because there were other things that I wanted to do. And Yeah, I didn't think that it was gonna come out in the way that it did. But the reason, one of the reasons, I guess, that I felt, super called to is just because so many people are turning to natural medicine for help with addiction and all of the related trauma and things that contribute to that, that I felt like it was an important thing for people to see. Not after the fact, but here where I am right now versus where I came from. And it's not pretty and it's not glamorous or cute or by any means, we wouldn't define like a very spiritually elevated thought process from a lot of these places that I've been to and come out of. But it's really just about like I'm here now and achieved a lot of the things that I've wanted to kind of despite that. And I feel like it has equipped me in a way that I can help other people fight those spirits. Because for me, there's very much a spiritual and unseen component to addiction. It's something that's transferred through bloodline, ancestry, and I understand it on a very deep level and a very spiritual level. And I think that that is something that is important for magical practitioners, people in the pagan community, witches, just whatever name. We've got so many adjectives for all this stuff, but whatever you want to call us, I think that there is a need for magical, esoteric addiction therapy or addiction support, just like there is for people who are part of the queer community. You want somebody
Absolutely.
that really, really, really understands your journey, your worldview, and how you perceive everything when you're going through something that is as traumatic as that. And just wanting it to be out there and be normalized. And you can have an addiction and you can be on methadone for a decade. And yeah, it sucks, but you can also write books while you're doing
This is
that
the
and go
thing,
to
right?
school and like do all of these other things. And granted, I wouldn't have had the stability to do that if it wasn't for like the 8 years that I was on methadone maintenance too. I count that as part of my recovery, but I was not, substance free for quite a while. And if we count like the times that I was, doing illicit drugs or actual drugs from the street, it doubles it. And that's just like a really big chunk of life. And there's, still a lot that I learned and did and happened through that period. And really lucky to have had the support and have the inner strength to make it where I did. But like the most profound thing was just kind of the realization of, so I'd been going through this recovery process and I've always been a practicing witch and I was studying the poisonous plants. Deadly Nightshade was my favorite. And then fast forward to about around the time like I'm starting to put the book together, which would have been a couple of years before I came off of the methadone completely. I just sort of had this realization. I was like, oh, Deadly Nightshade is a pain reliever. Deadly Nightshade is a sedative. It helps with nausea. It helps with diarrhea. It helps with muscle spasms. Like these are literally all the withdrawal symptoms that I'm super duper familiar with. And then on like further digging as a an antidote to like opium overdose, an old school antidote and things like there were just like all of these red flags that were like, oh, by the way, like I'm super witchy, but I'm also like really wrapped up in this whole like opioid epidemic kind of situation. So that was like, wow.
Yeah, it's I've heard and experienced this myself in other ways, in other parts of witchcraft. It can suddenly it's that weird cognitive dissonance piece, right? How did that impact your relationship then to Nightshade? being one of your favorites. What did that do to that relationship?
I think if anything, it strengthened it. You know, initially I was attracted to Deadly Nightshade because it just has a very sinister yet seductive air around it. And we often hear it described as this feminine spirit, which, you know, that's also a whole nother topic on like the gender of plant spirits and how we perceive them. But, you know, even just looking at the name Belladonna, there's a lot of different feminine elements that I totally resonate with, and just the seduction and influence and manipulation and power and death. And it's just very much like the evil witch down the road that nobody wants to fuck with. And but then finding out that, you know, it's like super supportive in all of these other ways that really like directly pertain to like my own personal journey. It's like, okay, so there is this side to them, this other side, but then when we're willing to sit with that and embody that and realize, you know, we're not, sometimes you have to go all the way to the extreme of that dark side and all of these different labels that have been thrown on you to kind of realize I can embody those things sometimes, but those things are not necessarily who I am or what makes me up. It's just about understanding their darkness and understanding your own darkness. And I feel like once you're able to genuinely sit with that and understand it and give it the care and recognition and love that it's looking for, that's when the shadows kind of pull away. And then all of these, you know, very supportive things that have been happening in the background, unbeknownst to you, also present themselves. And you're like, oh, okay. And then that empowers for them how you can help other people.
Absolutely. Having gone through that and experienced that shift from kind of disembodied to embodied, I love that you would use the word embody in there. Because quite a few of my friends who have found that witchcraft has been a healing tool for them in their journey through addiction, through their relationship with HIV or whatever it is, an STD or whatever it is, have said that disembodied piece has been the most shocking for them when they come back to their body, when they can relate to their body again. It strikes me that in relating to some of the plants that you've related to, I'm going to ask you what if that's not too uncomfortable, how did that shift with your relationship with your body?
It's been an ongoing process and it's still ongoing. It's like you really, really do hold all of your trauma in your body. And then to survive that, you take these substances that completely numb you to any of that and push you so far out of your body that all that is left is the trauma. So these things kind of give us the ability to start processing and letting go and clearing that out. So then when we do come back into our body and into our awareness, because now it is a safe space again, we realize like all of the turmoil that we've caused. So learning how to breathe again.
Yes.
Like my anxiety over the years has just been like so intense and so much that it's almost like crushed my inside here. So just learning how to really, really breathe and not like hold that breath up here, but let it go through the whole thing. That connects to like my posture and my back and just like all of these new pains that I kind of came back to after getting off all of the opiates, because you don't feel any of that. And then you're sort of relearning now, okay, I have to actually sit in a certain way or I'm going to be in a lot of pain, or, you know, just even being able to feel grounded and feel safe in that you are just like completely settled into your body and yourself. And you don't realize like how much of your mental state like affects how you hold and carry yourself and how just like physically exhausting that can be over years and years and years.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then to suddenly have that rush back again and to experience that. Yeah. So this might sound like a weird question. I'm curious about this piece because I feel like it ties back to what we were saying before about people being interested and initially in kind of the dangerous and the dark and the seductive, all of this. It's like a call to, right? I'm curious then in kind of that relationship rebuilding that relationship with your body, were there particular plants that you found were very helpful in pinpointing and showing you, and okay, this is, you know, focus here, or this is a part of your body that you haven't felt in a long time. I'm going to make you feel this. You know, was there any kind of relationship there? That makes any sense.
Yeah. So after I got off of the methadone, there was about a year, 2 years where no opiates. So I was just like smoking cannabis because I've always done that, and then drinking a little bit and whatever. But then I came down to Florida and I accidentally tried something called kratom, depending on how you pronounce it, which is an ethnobotanical plant medicine. It's from, I think, Indonesia or somewhere in like Southwestern Asia, and it's basically used as like a coffee substitute. It gives you energy, but it also has like the effect of taking a bunch of Vicodin or Percocet. You get like the warm fuzzies and you're real chatty, and it's really, really a great feeling, especially, you know, when you've not been on your methadone for 2 years. So that was a really welcome feeling, and I should have known better, but I didn't. And so I was drinking that for about 2 years. And I actually just stopped that completely in February. It's a much lower grade thing than shooting up heroin or taking Oxy or whatever. But still, you know, it's got that brain chemistry. And when you've got that addictive history or tendency, it's very, very easy to fall back on. You know, now you're leaning on this to push yourself and to do all of these things. And, you know, it was right around when the book was coming out, and then just like running a business. I have a shop, I'm doing book signing events, shipping orders, making formulas, trying to take care of my sister, just like all of these things. The kratom made it so I was able to go above and beyond and do all of that, but it also kind of took a lot away, and I was really angry at it for a while, just because of how sick it made me. But now that I'm off of that, and I've been able to kind of go through that process of just sort of feeling like all of this stuff coming out of me, there was a lot going on in like my liver, pancreas area, so what we would probably equate to anger, that was just like leaking out and causing like a lot of issues and things like that. You know, one beneficial thing that the kratom has is that it, for whatever reason, it makes it very uncomfortable for you to sit with any kind of emotions or transgression or like scenarios that don't make you uncomfortable. You're very, very, very quick to just be like, no. So kind of helping to find that voice again, in addition to like remembering how to breathe and, you know, working with vibration and projecting your voice and all of these just like interconnected things that it was able to kind of show me, you know, because basically it just like took the rubber band and wound it and wound it and wound it and wound it until it was so tight that I was having like all these weird neck issues and just more pains and things like that. And so going through like this whole kind of cleansing process and really flushing like all of that out and just letting my body kind of reorient itself for the first time in like 20 years. It taught me a lot about my body and just the physical nature of it. So sometimes it's, you know, when these substances or these plants or these pills or whatever you want to call them, you know, they take so much away, and they fill in all of these empty spaces that you have inside of yourself. And then before you know it, you're more the spirit of that plant or the spirit of that substance, whether it's alcohol or opiates or cocaine. You're more that entity than you are yourself, because there's no longer enough room for both of you to exist in the same space. So it's completely losing all of that and then slowly getting it back that you're really able to like find this renewed strength.
I really feel that part of my own journey in my life has been an addiction of a sort, and it really taking over my life to the extent that it destroyed my life at one point, and recovering from that. But I noticed that, again, all those coming out of your body piece, during the pandemic, I started using edibles a lot. I had never, like, cannabis was never something that I really used for myself. But at the same time, I was also introduced to mushrooms for the first time. Like, all of these pieces in my life really changed and opened up. And it came on the wake of me releasing a lot of the issues around control that I had in my life. Huge piece there. But what I noticed was that the relationship between mushrooms and weed for me was very counterproductive, because, you know, the mushroom was trying to really show me all those pieces, and the weed I was using as a way of getting away from that. And I remember having a conversation with both of my hands once while I was stoned out of my head, and being like, you know what, mushroom, I really love you, but you're too sharp, you know. Me blubbering in my apartment, right? But it's fascinating kind of in becoming aware of that and what was going on with my relationship with both of them, how much then I released. It was fabulous. It was painful, but it was fabulous.
Yeah. For me, it's been also getting past the fear and the trauma of having an addiction. You know, I think that certain people are predisposed, and, you know, there's certain things that can happen in people's lives, just irreversible trauma and just like terrible type scenarios where, unfortunately, you know, that's just so much a part of that person's makeup that, you know, that might be their journey for the entirety of their life. But for me, it was really, like you said, coming back to the control issues, the fear of losing control, the fear of experiencing pain and emotional discomfort, to realize then, you know, that I could come back to, you know, just like going out and having a beer and not being afraid that I'm going to wind up on like a downward spiral and in a gutter somewhere, or, you know, I can eat magic mushrooms, smoke cannabis, all of that. You know, there's a few that I would go back to just because of the whole opiate thing, but you kind of have to unlearn some of that fear again too, and give yourself permission, you know, to just be a human. And like, what works for one person doesn't work for everyone. And, you know, complete and utter sobriety and piety does not work for me.
I hear you. No, I would even go as far as to say that that is the realization that many people, not all, but many people come to, is an idea of needing that balance, right? Yeah, that balance, which really, if we extend that, again, comes back to the idea of a poison path, right? Balance is a huge part of that path, isn't it?
Yeah, because a lot is spoken about the poisonous properties, and it's called the poison path, and that's kind of the buzzword. But looking at them on a deeper level, we see that poison is a very enigmatic kind of a term, and poison in many cases is often equated to potency and power, and it is what makes a plant medicinal. You know, a low dose herb, which is something that's going to be very, very effective in very small doses in, you know, short-term scenarios. It's the same chemical compound that gives them that medicinal capability that also can make it potentially poisonous. So it's kind of this understanding of the weird nature of poison in general. And that's been a really, really big part of my work. It was never so much the entheogenic effects or mind altering effects or that maybe they could help me with my addiction. It was the fact that they were poisonous and that they could kill you. And part of me resonated with that deadly nature. And a lot of my more recent work has really been through understanding our perception of poison and how kind of the definition of that term has changed and been influenced by humans throughout history, and what it really means. And it's very much wrapped up in our understanding of disease and contagion, plague, which bleeds into then women and other minorities like Jewish people spreading plague, poisoning wells, fast forward to the witchcraft trials and all of these things, and is all wrapped up in this idea of poison. So it is kind of this toxic transmission snaking its way throughout history that I think if we can look at it as a full tapestry, we can really gain a lot of insight into really like the heart of what traditional witchcraft actually is and can be.
I totally agree. In that process then, for you, what surprised you most in learning to see that tapestry and become part of that tapestry? What has surprised you most?
Try not to give too long of a thought pause there. The whole thing is really surprising. It's just like the deeper you dig, the more connection you seem to find, and the more that it sets the stage for like how we even got to where we are in the witch world and our understanding of what witchcraft is, and just all of the things that influenced and fed into that. And looking back to like ancient Greece, the majority of witchcraft or even like state sanctioned magic was sort of focused around psychedelics and poisonous plants, and just sort of the understanding of that mechanism that was like shifting people's consciousness or causing these really dramatic physiological states was equated to, the miasma or the energy, the occult properties that these powerful substances gave off that weren't necessarily because of like their physical chemistry, but like just being around it could have a detrimental effect, or like they would almost give off this aura of like malevolence. And then you get into looking over into the East in traditional Chinese medicine and Chinese poison lore, and that, people were accused of actually like gathering up and cultivating these poisons because of their powerful nature, almost as like a familiar spirit to acquire wealth and destroy their enemies. And so for me, poison is analogous to witchcraft around the world.
I really love that. It reminds me of something that Lee Morgan wrote in their latest book around cannibalism, that idea of taboo, that idea of danger, that idea of destruction and creation at the same time. It's something that I wonder how much goes by the wayside because of. Actually, I don't even know what I'm trying to say with that. I don't know what I'm trying to say with that. But it is that idea of danger and that empowerment in that, right?
Yeah, there would always be things. I remember, when I was a teenager, just doing like random occult research and stuff, there would be certain books or certain words or certain things that just kind of made me feel like, oh, I don't want to mess with that. Like, that's spooky. Of course, like the Ars Galatia thing, like ritual magic, demonic related or anything like that, kind of struck like this chord of fear within me that I thought was strange because I was super interested in all of this stuff. But even then, there seemed to be this realm that I was not ready to touch upon yet. And now all of these years later, and I'm just like, oh, whatever, it'll be fine, everything's fine, it's all great.
That actually, that's a good segue for my next question. Something that I've been asking a lot of our colleagues, and this is something I found myself. When you focus, something people don't realize, when we focus in on writing a book on a very particular topic, they can often, I experience this, I'm not sure if you did as well, but they can often be that sense of, okay, I'm over it. I don't want to know anything more about it. I'm done. This is an expert subject for me. And there can be that ego around that, right? I'm curious, what was it like for you to write a book and so heavily invest in this subject? What was it like for you then to come back to the basics of this? What's your relationship like now, having gone through that process of having to represent it back to the world? What's that like?
It's definitely given me a deeper understanding and sort of strengthened, you know, what I already know personally, having to verbalize that in one way or another so that other people can understand it. But definitely, you know, anytime I write something, whether I'm putting together a lecture presentation or an article or writing a book, you know, I very much am channeling the energies, the spirits, the plants, and just all of these things are being transmitted through me. You know, I feel like the plants have their side of the story. The other associated spirits have things that they want to get out. You know, my own familiar spirits have their opinions and voice, and all of this is kind of like just going through. You know, sometimes, like, I just taught a course on vampiric herbalism in Salem at the end of July. And essentially taught everyone how to construct a vampiric servitor with poisonous plants. And the week later was when I got the horrible 3-week-long COVID. You know, so some of these energies are a little bit more difficult to transmit, and you can kind of feel yourself starting to get bogged down in them. And, you know, just using the vampiric herbalism as an example, you know, I start to find my own energetic influence behaving in a way that is more vampiric. The spirits that I start working with start to take on a darker tone, a more sexual tone. You know, all of these different things start to come up. You know, so writing like The Leo Witch is all about the sun and being a Leo and being glamorous and confident, and is very, 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 very different from like anything that I typically write about. And so that right there is just like evidence in, you know, when magical practitioners that are authors or teachers or speakers, when we're like putting this stuff on a page or out there into the world, like we're channeling and we're tapping into all of these different things that run through us. And it's a very it's crazy, you know.
I do. No, I do. I do. I do.
Sometimes you think you're going nuts.
Yeah. Well, I know I'm nuts. That's the main difference, right?
That's the difference.
Well, I'm glad that you raised the new book, because I was going to ask that about you about that anyways, and kind of the dichotomy, because it is such a different book. First of all, what was it like to co-author that with Ivo? Like, what was that process like for you?
Yeah, so he is amazing. I've always loved, and now I'm going to forget the title of it, The Astrology for Pagans and Witches. I thought that's always been one of my favorite books on astrology, and just like the level of knowledge and insight, and being able to marry that with magical practice and talk about it in a way that, you know, experienced occult practitioners are getting like new ideas and new insights and things like that is really, really awesome. So that was cool. And he's just a super nice and positive guy anyway. But on the down low, I was kind of a little bit like, oh my gosh, I can't believe like they asked me to write this book about being a Leo, because I've always kind of joked about how I'm a bad Leo and I don't really embody any of the qualities. And, you know, so much of my perceived public persona is wrapped up in shadows and darkness and poisonous plants. And now here I am, the child of the sun, talking about that. It was weird. It was really weird. But I think it was something that I needed to kind of go through on my own too, realizing that I am a lot more Leo than I thought, and really kind of like coming full circle. And now I've really gone through this just very long and drawn out dark period, and kind of coming out of it now with all of these, positive qualities and attributes and strengths that now I can associate with the Leo archetype. But before, I just didn't see them in myself because I was still in my dark cave.
Sometimes the best thing to learn about yourself is to write a book about something, right? Yeah, I found that too.
You got to know your opinions and what you think about everything.
And things changed too during the span of me writing mine. Like I completely almost 180'd on some of my opinions because I really challenged them, right? I know you've been working with this one in particular. It was such a long process for you to bring it together and put it. And I don't mean long processes in with any form of judgment there, but it was a long process for
it
you.
It was, yeah.
Yeah. What was the biggest change, do you think, since 2017 for you? What did you learn most about yourself?
Oh dear.
I know, big
That's
question.
That's a
sorry.
Big can of worms. just speaking about the book, a lot of it was very kind of abstract, esoteric extrapolation, based on my own opinion, and very much kind of rooted in the sort of traditional witchcraft mythos, a lot of Sabbatic witchcraft influence and things like that. And, looking back on it, that was very much like my own personal lens for it, and still has a lot of relevance to me and my personal practice and to a lot of people as well. And that's kind of one thing that I've learned about myself and also about the poison path in general, is that the poison path is very, very highly individualistic, and I would never ever attempt to like define that for anyone else, for the simple fear that somebody's going to come and poison me. The poison path as a descriptor since its inception by Dale Pendle has always been associated with European witchcraft and paganism. And I could quote a definition somewhere, and I probably do in the book, but it's always kind of been entrenched in that. And that's really the path that it has sort of taken in the online community to kind of blossom into what it is now. But now we've also got all of these witches, plant medicine practitioners, green alchemists, psychonauts, mushroom people, from all over the world that are seeing the interest and seeing the correlation. And so it's not all just about traditional witchcraft or European witchcraft. And so a big part of that for me is learning, like, okay, the reason that I was attracted to European poisonous plants in the first place was because I'd identified with a European root of the witchcraft tree. And that was something that was important to me. So I still like to talk about that, and I still like to hold space for that. And I know that it's important to a lot of other poison path practitioners, kind of that archetypal witch image that is rooted in, European mythology or European whatever. But then we also start getting all of these streams of information from other communities as well that work with plants that are mind altering or psychoactive, just the plant medicine communities in South America. So my sister's a plant medicine practitioner. She lives down in Ecuador. She facilitates ceremonies. She does all of these things. So over the past couple of years, I've seen like a lot of these parallels and correlations, including like the demonization of plant medicine from one perspective, to another, associating them with poison, death, bad
Right.
witchcraft, all of these things. So that happens in other places too. But I also don't want to create like an umbrella term and say, oh, ayahuasca is the poison path, rapé is the poison path. You know, there's definite corollaries and areas of overlap, but I don't want to speak for somebody else's tradition or lineage and try and lump it in with this thing. But then I also don't want to say that can't be part of the poison path, because it totally can be. I mean,
well, so that's the thing, right?
Not up to me. It's not up to me. And thank God it's not, because we wouldn't get anything done.
Well, I mean, that's a fascinating point, because was it this year? When was it translated into Spanish? Because it was translated in Spanish recently, wasn't it?
Yeah, I reached out to them. I think it might have been over the winter. And they did the translation, which is now available, Herbolario de la Senda de los Venenos.
Oh, beautiful.
So, literal direct translation. And that was really important for me to have done. So we've always had kind of a connection to. So my stepdad is Mexican. My sister lives in Ecuador. All three of us are semi sort of fluent in Spanish, the one sister much more so. You know, so I didn't write it. Someone translated it for me. Of course, I'm not that great, especially when it comes to like botanical vocabulary, but it was important for me to like present that to them and be like, hey, there's a big demand for information about this in Spanish speaking countries as well, because they are also very much influenced by European witchcraft. You know, Brazil specifically, Mexico, you know, you name it, and that the interest is definitely there. You know, so I'm just trying to be careful and trying to be considerate and not be like gatekeepery and say,
right.
Oh, this isn't part of the poison path. But then I also don't want to take, you know, somebody's ancestral tradition and then, you know, wrap it all up in brujas and witchcraft and things like that, because there's a very different connotation when you talk to an indigenous Shuar plant medicine practitioner about brujeria and poison. This is a very, very different thing for them. And not always seen in the best light. So it's important to just sort of be aware, I guess, when you're talking about things, that the words don't always mean same
makes,
thing
no,
to
it totally,
everybody. Yeah.
No, it totally does. No, it totally does. I feel like that, again, like just as we, our traditions can be so anthrocentric, human-centric, I feel like so often traditional witchcraft anyways, and well, yeah, I'm going to say this. I think a lot of traditional witchcraft is very Anglo-centric. We tend to assume, and I think neo-paganism is as well, we tend to assume that the wordage that we're using often translates directly to all of the other cultures around the world. But as somebody
yes.
with ATR experience, you know, witch in Lukumi and Afro-Cuban traditions means something very different from witch in Anglo-centric traditions. Even in Welsh
yes.
traditions, I was having a conversation with Mara Starling about this. The idea of, you know, people translating witch into Welsh and it really them translating it meaning a monstrous being, kind of that folkloric idea of a witch as opposed to a practitioner, a human witch, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's that I think that I think that that's the hazard of and the constraints of language when it comes to so many of these pieces. Yeah
it is, it does come down to the constraints of language. I had a friend of mine just kind of in conversation made a comment that kind of like hurt my feelings a little bit, just talking about traditional witchcraft, and that traditional witchcraft was essentially like white people witchcraft. And, you know, there's a lot of like linguistics in there and who's doing the talking and who's doing the listening and things like that. I totally get what you're saying, that it is very, very Anglo-centric, traditional witchcraft, and sort of by proxy, the poison path kind of started out that way too. And I would say that it's not that way anymore necessarily just because of its growth, but it definitely kind of started out that way, and that the interest was in, flying ointments and the nightshade family, and it was very, very specific. So trying to expand that into like a global culture without being a gross person.
And that's a good segue, actually, to some of your other work. You have a conference coming up. When is the I've completely forgotten what it's called. I'm sorry. When is your conference coming up?
The conference is coming up this March. This year it will be the 8th, 9th, and 10th of March for Botanica Obscura Conference. And that's kind of another way for me to open up the, I don't know, open the floor, open the forum to, a variety of other practitioners. Not all of them are poison path practitioners. Some of them are more in the realm of psychedelic spirituality or various different plant medicine traditions, herbalists, academics, and that, and just kind of really digging into plant spirit work and what that means and all of the different ways that that is approached. So I try and keep it super diverse. I've got presenters from all different corners of the world talking about their plants and their practices.
Beautiful. I love that. I'm looking forward to seeing more about it. And this is what, the second or third year you've been running, or is this the first?
It'll be the third.
Third. Wow. Wow. I apologize. The pandemic just timey-wimey in my head. Things seem to flow together. Yeah,
It's
that's
okay.
very
There was a good
powerful.
month. I thought that I had like dementia or something because I would just lose chunks of information. Like, I don't know. I don't know.
Things happen. Things just will happen when they
Yeah.
need to. This has been delightful. Thank you so much for coming on and speaking with me, Kobe. If people want to learn more about you, the conference, your other work, your classes that you're offering in the book, where can people go?
Everything can be found at thepoisonersapothecary.com. If you're interested in taking a deep dive into poison path lore and information, you can support me on Patreon, patreon.com/poisonersapothecary. And I pretty much post about everything in all of the places. So those would be the two best ones.
Wonderful. I will put all those links down below. And thank you for coming on again. This was a wonderful chat, and I'm really, really pleased that I could include you in this fall series. For those of you who are listening, join me next time as I go into the woods again and meet another folkloric or traditional craft practitioner. And I have been Ben Stimson. This has been Kobe Michael. Thank you so much for watching.
Thank you.